everybody, I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story Is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the traces of the one reality that lie below the surface.
That's right, that's right. And I'm coming to you live from Miami. Lovely Miami.
Is it humid?
It is humid.
Yeah.
It is humid. But it's been lovely. Back home, it's 96 degrees. And here it's only 85 degrees.
That's nuts. It's the sea.
It's backwards. It's
the sea regulates it.
Exactly.
Or something.
Yes.
I don't know.
Well, this is episode what? 87?
I think so.
Yes, episode 87. And today we're going to talk about Agent to the Stars by John Scalzi,
which is set next to a different sea in California. Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Where the weather's
That's
very
right.
different. Yeah, it's in hot.
Over there in movie country.
Yeah. And I picked mm-hmm. this because, well, for one thing, I just had reread it recently, and it's a light, summery kind of book. Movies, I think of movies when I think of summer, and this is all mm-hmm. about movies because it's about the
True.
Agent to the Stars.
Yeah, and I enjoyed that aspect of the novel. Well, I enjoyed the whole novel.
Oh, good.
It's very funny. Made me laugh. Out loud a couple of times. And I listened to this one. I should mention that. I listened to this narrated by Will Wheaton,
mm-hmm.
who did a absolute wonderful job, I thought.
He was great, I thought, mm-hmm. too.
Yeah. It would have been so easy to go over the top with this, but I thought he just struck the perfect tone.
Yes. And in fact, there was this one, oh gosh, I can't remember the name of this movie director who's French. I loved the way he did that guy's voice. It was so different. I forgot I was even listening to the same person.
Oh, that's cool.
So, yeah.
Yep. Loved it. I loved it. So, so you mentioned an agent. You know, the book is kind of two things at once, really.
Yes.
There was a lot of inside baseball, not really baseball, just inside behind the scenes what it's like to be a movie agent.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoyed that aspect of it. And then there's also
Hello?
The first contact part.
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay. And there was also the first contact part, which I also loved. I love a good first contact story, and I love a good comedy, and this is both, too.
Yes. And this is, yes, the title is a double entendre because he's not only the agent to the stars as Hollywood stars, he's agent to aliens from the stars. And I guess you could sum up the book in saying that if you are an alien species that's very friendly, wants to make contact, but you have been watching a lot of TV and movies that are broadcast into outer space, and you know that your very appearance and way of communicating is completely offensive and disgusting, how do you get across your inner self? How do you get people past your appearance? And their answer is they hire an agent whose job is to sell people who might not be the perfect person to get them jobs. And so that's what they do. They get a Hollywood
yep.
agent.
Hollywood agent named Tom Stein.
Yes.
Yep.
And I love the fact that this comes across from two different people. One is one of the aliens, and then much later in the book, it's from a journalist who covers the entertainment business. But the whole idea is that American movies speak for the world. They say,
Yeah. I thought that was very interesting. There was a few paragraphs about that, how the American movie, you know, speaks culturally to everybody.
Mm-hmm.
We've said similar things. I think that they're right. I think it affects the culture quite a bit.
Yeah, I think so, because they were saying, why didn't you land on the White House lawn? And they said, well, your president speaks for Americans. American movies speak for the world. And then later this reporter is saying how people around the world want their world to be is like the one they see in the films. That's why different countries have laws saying you have to show this percentage of native-made films and that kind of thing, which I wasn't aware of.
Hmm.
But and it did make me stop and think, we obviously love the movies and the stories they tell. And I was talking to somebody a couple days ago about how we may not be the best represented that way. People look at the stereotypes of American movies and they judge us based on those movies. They take them as true.
Yeah, sure.
And a lot of the times it's not true. You know, American women don't just go around sleeping with every guy who comes along if they're not married kind of thing.
Well,
that was the subject of the conversation. Like, why do European men think women are just going to, American women will sleep with anyone? Well, let's look at movies and TV. Where have they learned it?
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, movies and stories, they talk to us at a different level, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the reasons why I enjoy doing this podcast so much is, you know, it speaks to me on a certain level that, you know, I like to share on this podcast. But there's a lot of philosophy being shared through that culture. And I think movies are the closest thing that we have to a shared experience.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, you know, we have novels, but, you know, let's face it, not a heck of a lot of people read novels. You know, out of the people that I know in my day-to-day life, you know, maybe I'm just going to throw out a number, maybe a fifth of them read.
I know.
You know, something like that. It is sad, but everybody watches movies.
Yes.
I don't know many people at all that don't. And a lot of people are getting their philosophy from these movies.
Which is kind of scary.
It is kind of scary.
Because people who watch a lot of movies don't necessarily watch the kind of movies that have a broad philosophy or, you know, broad ranges of philosophy. They pick the kind of movie they like, and that's the kind of movie they see.
Yeah.
And I do that as the same as anybody, you know. So.
Oh, sure. As do I. Yeah, you know, sometimes when you watch something or any kind of story, really, it hits you in a certain way. And I think that a person can feel things in a story, watching a movie or reading a book, that a person doesn't feel when, you know, being presented with that same information a different way.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think that that's what the aliens had struck on. And I think that that was a really interesting commentary on our culture.
Yeah, because their whole quest is to be able to see below the surface. As I was saying, they are they're gelatinous creatures, and this was fascinating to me. Their language is smells, and wow, what a brilliant idea!
Yes,
that makes complete sense to me. And the funny thing, though, was never did anyone describe a good smell they were making. All the smells just started off bad and got much worse.
Yeah.
And
it was nice of the alien that brought him up there to offer him the nose plugs.
Which didn't do the whole job, but it did enough that they could live with it. Right.
It would have been funny to have him faint and then say, oh, we should have given you nose plugs.
Well, I like at one point somebody says, whoa, it smells so awful in here. They're like, oh, I'm sorry. There was a lot of shouting. We'll get the air circulating. Oh, that was a nice
oh my gosh, yeah.
But
too fun.
And it's obvious when you think about the fact that we're talking about Hollywood, we're talking about these aliens who are just so difficult to even take in how they look and communicate. But it wasn't until this time through the book I was like, everything he's saying is about how we judge on appearances, how we don't look deep enough when we're talking to people or thinking about them. I mean, there's a star who is just a blonde bimbo, and she wants so much to show that she's not stupid and that she's deeper. And she just literally cannot understand the experiences of people in the Holocaust when she's trying to get enough background to read for this part, where she'd have to be about 20 or 30 years older to be the person to really play them.
Yeah.
And so it's all about how are we perceived and how can
Wow, I really didn't make that connection. That's cool because, yeah, the aliens and her were both kind of going through the same thing.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah, and she well, thank you. And she fails because she is that stupid. And it's when she realizes that the big, you know, crisis point in the movie comes as far as she's concerned.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And she's just so stupid actually, that she thought, oh, I'll kill myself. That'll show him. And then later she's like, oh, damn, I really am going to kill myself. Well, how can I fix this? I don't want to do that, you know. She was just mad like a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, but so yeah. Looking at Michelle's story and looking at the alien story and then the fact that the alien named Joshua, which is a Hebrew basically version of Jesus,
mm-hmm.
winds up being the bridge using Michelle's memories and everything. It's very redemptive for her character in a sense.
Yeah.
Makes her bigger than she would have been. And brings
wow.
together.
I mean, that's cool too.
Right?
I didn't even catch that. That's awesome.
We'll do
I did catch that you know, they said, hey, we want to name this alien Jesus, and Tom Stein is like, no, that's not a good idea.
This is a terrible idea.
That's not going to have the effect that you want it to have.
Yeah.
That was funny.
Yeah, and they go, well, here's the Hebrew name is Joshua, and that's because it was Carl, and he said, you know, the baby he and his wife would have had if she hadn't died would have been named Joshua, so that it works because the book gets complicated, but for such a simple book, it's kind of complicated sometimes. But anyway, he is, in a sense, a father to this one alien, and so he gives him that name. But it was later when, at the end of the book, when Michelle is turning completely crystal and saying, can you see that there's below the surface is someone who's just like you? And that's when I was like, oh, my gosh, it is, in that sense, a Jesus figure.
How about that?
Connecting yep. and part of both.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I like it. That's pretty cool.
I was really proud of myself for thinking that one. But like I say, third time through the book, so.
That's right. Well, that's cool. That's
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
And, you know, it is, you know, completely enjoyable enough to go through three. I wonder, it would make a pretty good movie, you know.
I know.
I keep saying that stuff, but,
you're
but
right,
I think
though.
This one would be very funny. This
yeah.
would be very funny stuff.
It really would.
Yeah.
Well, and, of course, then thinking about just appearance was that when Tom Stein goes to see these clients who are unhappy because somebody else is going to be handling them. And so you see just how avaricious or mean-spirited or selfish or stupid all these people really are. And it doesn't give you a very good opinion of Hollywood, but what it did was give me a really wonderful feeling about Tom Stein himself, because he really was trying to do the best for all these people without having any illusions about what they were like. He knew,
mm-hmm.
but he was like, well, your career has to go like this. And one of the things I really admired about him that I think helped him both look good to us and also look below the surface was, instead of immediately jumping in with the objections to what he knew these people were really upset about, he would ask them questions.
Yeah.
And he'd wait for them to answer, and by using the answers that they themselves gave him, it allowed him to reason with them instead of being pushy or obnoxious.
Mm-hmm.
And it made
that
me think.
He did. Yeah.
Yeah, it made me think of the appearance thing, and I thought, you know, this is something that missionaries must have to deal with all the time. How do you show what our faith really is like?
Mm-hmm.
When it looks like something so different from the outside or from the little that people see. And then I thought, well, I guess that's our problem, because we are missionaries in what's now being called a lot of the time a post-Christian world.
Fascinating. I just love all this stuff you're finding in here. This is really fun. Yeah. All in a very fun book too.
Right.
You know, so yeah, Tom Stein is, you know, he's told in a meeting that, hey, by the way, we want you to be the agent to this alien species who wants the world to be ready when they're revealed. And then, you know, it's just a cool idea. It's very funny. And this is Scalzi's first novel.
Mm-hmm.
He wrote it. I looked this up. I once heard a story that he put it out on the web and somebody found it and published it, but it turns out that that is not actually true.
Well, he wrote that as the afterword of this edition of the book I'm reading.
Okay.
Actually.
On Wikipedia, it says he put it out on the web. Oh. Right?
Uh-huh.
And then he published Old Man's War to Tor.
Right.
And then they Subterranean Press picked up Age Into the Stars and published it. But it was after Old Man's War. And Old Man's War was a big success.
Well,
so what does
he doesn't say, okay, this is actually the foreword. He doesn't say that Old Man's War came out first, but he doesn't even mention it. He just says in 1997, he started writing it to see if he could write a novel.
Mm-hmm.
In 1999, he put it on his website, asking people to send him a dollar if they liked it. And so over the next 5 years, he made $4,000.
Huh.
And then he finally said, stop sending me money. And then in 2005, a publisher of Subterranean Press found it and asked if he could publish it in a limited edition hardcover.
Okay.
And he said yes, and they printed 1,500
partially right.
copies.
Partially right. So he wasn't discovered that way.
No,
he didn't. It was just that Subterranean Press said, hey, cool, let's publish that.
I think that must be it. And then he says in 2008 it's come out again now. And that's because I got it from the library so I could find some of the spots that I was hearing zip by in the audiobook.
Yeah, it looks like Tor has published it.
Okay. Oh, yeah, the Tor, the one I have right now, the newer one, is the Tor book. Mm-hmm. And he said he went through, because this is 2008, and so he updated some of the cultural references. And he said, but that's the last time I'm going to touch it. It's just going to have to age.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Okay. That's cool.
Yeah.
So one of the things that I found in this novel that really touched me was, and this is going to be very spoilerific, so for those of you who would like to read the novel, now would be a good time.
Because I haven't already spoiled it, so sorry, everyone.
Sorry, excuse me. Well, Michelle, the actress, feels so dumb after this audition that she bombed for this Holocaust movie. She has to go get a mask done for a science fiction film that is not going to take a lot of acting.
Yeah.
But at this point, you know, she feels maybe that's the only thing she'll ever be or she'll ever get is that kind of a role. So things happen, and she ends up having an accident. She can't breathe through the nose of her mask.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so then as they start to – as it progresses, they start to talk about, well, what happened? They don't know for sure what happened. Did she freak out under the mask? Did someone actually come pull the nose straws out, was the only way that she could breathe, or that? But and then somebody said, well, you know, maybe she did it to herself. And then, you know, I kind of dismissed it at that point.
Mm-hmm.
But then as the story went on, I realized that. And then the touching part was when the alien was going to kind of take over her body, he had a moral objection to doing it because if she did it to herself, which later they found out was true,
mm-hmm.
that it would be morally incorrect for him to go against her will and bring her to life. Now, the touching part was when Tom Stein said, what if she didn't want to be dead?
Yeah.
And it was almost a redemption thing right there. You know, one of the things that we believe as Catholics, you know, it could happen at the very last moment
mm-hmm.
of your life. You know,
and
that's what happened to her. She did it to herself. She did pull the straws out. And then suddenly when she realized that she had really done that to herself, she clearly did not want to die.
Yeah.
And I found that a really touching point.
I hadn't thought about that.
Well, cool.
Good one, Scott.
1-to-1. Yes, baby.
That's right. Well, and the thing that whole sequence set off that I really liked was that there was a real concern for life there.
And there really was. And that's the thing, you know, when you talk about that, you know, and you know, suicide is so hard.
Yeah.
It's just difficult. You know, I often wish, you know, when I hear about that, you know, if people would just, you know, it's like you owe it to your future self to hang in there.
Yeah.
You know, you don't know what's going to happen, and you don't know what your future self is going to look back and see what you've learned through everything.
Mm-hmm.
And to in this book, to see Michelle go through that in such a short space of time,
mm-hmm.
and look back on that, you know, she really did have a short space of time, but but realize that what she had done and that she did not want to do that. You know, that's what I'd urge people to do, is just, you know, you owe it to your future self. The person who has learned through everything that's occurred.
Yeah.
To hang in there.
Yeah.
So very touched by it.
Well, that and the whole idea too, that she, as a person, as an individual, was so important that whatever her free will chose was what those aliens were going to honor.
Yeah.
And they also kept talking about soul.
They did. I saw that too. And I was like, well, that's interesting.
They would change it, but they'd say, well, whatever her soul wanted, or, you know, we would mesh souls or whatever to make a new baby or whatever it is. But, so there was that. And there was also the fact that when they're on the ship and they're talking about, well, what will happen if you can get into her memory and see, you know, if she really wanted to do this or not, what if she did want to die? And they said, well, then we'll take her off the respirator and let her die. And they're like, okay. And then they said, well, they get to a further stage and go, you're going to try and reformat her brain, or, you know, mm-hmm. make her a new brain, essentially, using other information. They said, well, what happens to her actual brain? Well, we'll throw it away. And they were like, well, that's awful. I don't like to think of her being treated like parts. Mm. And I didn't expect that.
Yeah, yeah.
Because at that point, it's really, I mean, they've kind of dealt with all the moral issues of what did she want and how would they handle it and how are you going to honor her? Such as when, what was the Miranda?
Yeah.
Says, mm-hmm. Well, if you're going to make new memories for her and see if you can fix the roots of her brain so you can get in there and use her body, then I want you to keep as much of Michelle as you possibly can. And they said, well, that could be really dangerous and it's going to take longer and it might put you at risk. And she said, I don't care. This is non-negotiable. She herself was important as a person, and you will preserve everything you can of her. And it's, of course, the honorable thing to do. But at that point, you know, they could have let a lot of that go, and I don't think anybody would have noticed.
True.
In the story.
Yeah. Fascinating.
Yeah.
But you're right. Yeah, that is holding life up is a very special thing, which, of course, it is.
Well, and the other thing, too, is that this story is being told in juxtaposition with the idea that Michelle Beck wanted to get this part in this movie called Hard Memories, which was about a Holocaust survivor who then came to this country and was in the civil rights movement. And
was that person a real person? Or was it fictional?
Wow, I thought it was fictitious. I didn't look it up.
Okay, I was just curious.
Yeah, but at one point, you don't know why the movie is called Hard Memories, but I think I marked it. There's a spot in the book where she kind of summarizes what her life has meant. And, of course, now I can't find it. Wait a minute.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the movie will be made about someone named Sarah Rosenthal.
That's it.
And I don't know... just looking it up on the internet here, there's a lot of Sarah Rosenthals, but nothing's leaping out, so I don't know if she is fictional or not.
Okay. Well, and I thought I had marked it, but I guess I didn't. But
yeah, but it was a remarkable story. I mean, the movie would have been something.
Well, it was great.
So that's what made me think maybe it wasn't fictional, because it seems so real, and the quotes and all of that from her. And her talking about how wonderful her memories were,
yes.
At her death. That was something, too.
Well, and that was the thing that kind of really made it, was she was talking about, you know, I remember that I was part of a group of people who it was decided they didn't have any right to live. She, meaning Sarah Rosenthal, wrote in Time magazine, "I feel the work I have done was the work I was destined to do. I know what it is to lose my rights and to be told that I have no right to exist, to see my family, my friends, and my humanity stripped away from me. These are hard memories, couched in sorrow and anger. But I also know what it is to see others begin to gain their rights and their humanity, to be told, yes, you are our brothers and sisters. Come join us at the family table and be welcome. My work, though such a small part of a larger whole, has helped to make this a reality. It makes those hard memories a little easier to bear because these memories, they are glorious."
Wow. See, that's awesome.
Yes, and I just listened really to something. That and thought, John Scalzi, you could do better. You know, I was like, what? How come there's no depth like that? I mean, and of course what it is this is the depth of the book, because not only does it define this person from the Holocaust and everything, and the fact that Michelle Beck just doesn't have the equipment to play her, like they go, this is the woman that Michelle Beck wanted to portray. Could she do it? Well, she was the right sex, you know. But what it's doing is putting another layer on that, judging by appearances, judging by labels. And that little speech, of course, works exactly for the aliens, too.
Yeah,
you know,
sure,
others began to gain their rights and their humanity. Can you come join us at the family table? And by playing that part, Joshua, who's become Michelle, shows that he understands it, that they do understand human beings. And it's interesting that the suffering and struggles of the Holocaust and the civil rights movement are what show the depth of humanity needed for everybody to say, you do get us.
Hmm.
It's not through the joyful stuff, although that's part of it.
It's through the suffering.
Yeah, it's through the suffering and the struggles to overcome it for what's right.
Yeah.
And what's better.
Wow. Yeah, that was something else. Yeah, when I heard that, and Will Wheaton read it, you know.
Oh,
course, that's
he read
how I heard
it much
it.
Better than I did, believe
me. No, come on. No, you were terrific. But
no.
He blew me away. I thought it was great.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That was one of those things where I was like, oh, yeah, man. He's good.
Well read, well written.
Yes.
You bet.
Yeah.
So I wonder, I've read the only other Scalzi novel. Have you read Old Man's War?
I have.
I have too.
I don't remember.
That's the only other one that I've read.
Okay, me too.
Mm-hmm.
I liked it, but I did not find it to have the depth, if one can say that, of this novel. It didn't match it, I didn't think.
Yeah, and I liked it, but I haven't read any others.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got several now, so it's not something that, you know, I was totally enamored with, otherwise I'd have been following it closer. But
right.
Yeah, and he won a Hugo Award for Red Shirts.
Okay. That's the other
which thing. Is another comedy, so I wonder if it's got some depth to it, too.
Yeah, I don't know, because that's all based on Star Trek, and anybody who watches that knows that, you know, if you're going down on the big mission with the captain and you're one of those anonymous red shirted guys, you're probably going to get killed. And it's all told from their point of view, but I don't know. I think I've seen very mixed reviews of it.
Uh-huh.
I guess it either
hits you. I have as well. Yeah, I think so. It sounds like it. But Will Wheaton read it. You know, I'm probably going to try it out.
Oh.
7.5 hours long or so.
Right.
But hey, that may be exactly what I need down here in Miami.
Something light.
Something light.
Definitely something light.
Indeed. So cool. But yeah.
Oh, go ahead.
No, just back to this book.
Yeah.
I was struck by it as well. You know, you found some things in there that have really got me thinking here that, you know, again, as I so often happens on this podcast, I'm like, okay, now I need to read it again with that in mind. Because it's probably a lot of stuff in there that I missed. But I really like the aliens.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I wanted to say is that the book had a feel to me, and I don't know how you feel about this book, Calculating God by Sawyer, Robert J. Sawyer. I know Sawyer is not your very favorite author, but there were aliens in this book, Calculating God,
yeah,
that kind of reminded me of the tone of the aliens in this one.
And I've been wanting to reread that book. I read it a long time ago, and I really liked it. I didn't like the end.
Yeah, right.
And which is the problem for me with his books, just because he'll have these great ideas, and I feel like he just doesn't, he's not hard-nosed enough to really follow through all the conclusions that his story leads to, I think, sometimes.
Yeah.
But that aside, I found that a very interesting book, but I don't remember much about the aliens, and I've read it
The aliens at the very beginning, the alien lands at a museum in Toronto, I think.
Okay.
Somewhere in Canada. And then walks up and says, you know, he wants to see the fossils. And he basically, he's a globe with three arms or legs.
Oh.
And, but it was really more in how the alien spoke and things.
Mm-hmm.
And by coincidence, it's also an excellent audiobook read by Jonathan Davis. But the thing that I'd say that most marks Calculating God for me is that it's really an outline of the arguments for and against the existence of God.
Mm-hmm.
Because the alien in that novel believes in God and can't believe that there are people or humans that don't, which is the opposite of so much that you read.
I love Arthur C. Clarke
when he says, you know, that the aliens are always above religion, right?
Yeah.
They're like, yeah, religion, papa. But then there's always a godlike character in it.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah.
Something even more powerful that we cannot explain.
Yeah.
Always. Yeah.
I know. I think, but you're right. That is the idea, that if we meet aliens, they'll be so advanced, they will not believe in God, or they'll be advanced technologically, but they won't be really that advanced. They'll be like, you know, some savage fighting group, and they might have a warlike god. That just shows they're not really as advanced as they should be.
Exactly.
And it's interesting. We've all bought into that, haven't we?
We really have. It's become almost like a progress. That's what progress is.
Yeah.
Progress is moving past religion, and we can see it now, like you said earlier. We're in a post-Christian world,
mm-hmm.
you know, is what people are starting to call it, and you know, everybody's believing it too.
Mm-hmm.
And yet this book, Agent to the Stars, there wasn't any specific mention of alien religion that I recall. But yet, like you said, you know, they're talking about souls, and they clearly have a morality. You know, not that you know, morality and religion, you can be moral without religion,
I'm just saying
that's, again, an interesting aspect of the aliens.
Well, and something I liked about them that maybe felt as if there was something deeper that we just weren't being told was when they talk about, I could have sworn I just wrote this down in my quote journal. I will find it and read it to you, never fear. But when they're talking about things that are really important, like when they're melding to make a new Yeherigic is the name of their race.
Right.
They talk about it, and I did write this down. It says, the melding isn't easy. It requires the Yeherigic in question to surrender its will and allow another entity, another soul, to mingle freely with its own. This other soul surrenders to you and you to it. Complete communion.
Hmm.
And then later on, and this is Carl talking about this, who was the first person they contacted. He's the boss. He's Tom Stein's boss. So he's one of the most powerful people on the planet, as it turns out. But when he's talking about it, I kind of connected that with when Tom Stein is all worried because he's not getting things done fast enough. And he says, why aren't they just doing this? They could do it so much more easily. And Carl says something like, well, for them, it's not simply a matter of the most efficient way of doing something. And he says, otherwise Joshua would be talking to the UN right now. He says, there's that notion the Yeherigic have of surrendering to the crucial moment, burned right down into their reproductive strategies. I think that once again they're surrendering the moment to us. They're saying, here, we trust you to take this, the most important moment in the history of both our races, and make it work. Mm. And I thought about that whole concept of this race, maybe knowing better, but saying we'll take the risk for that complete surrender, whether it's for their reproductive system or whatever, or this whole concept that Carl thinks maybe, you know, they're trusting the people that much, that you know things better than we do. We're going to let you do your job. And I thought, isn't that how it's supposed to be for the reproduction part with a man and a woman? We can't surrender mm-hmm. as completely as the heretic. We're made differently. But how often does that get misused?
Yeah.
To where we're not being completely trusting. We're not with somebody where this is the most important thing and you're surrendering as completely as you should. Or, and then I thought about, well, of course, that's what we should be doing with God.
Yeah.
And I thought, that's kind of an interesting notion that the author has built into these aliens. This idea of they might know better, but they're going to go along with that idea of complete surrender or surrendering to the crucial moment.
Yeah, that's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
It just kind of put an interesting spin on it.
Sure does. It sure does. Yeah, and then Joshua himself as a product of all that and
mm-hmm.
ends up being the bridge, like you said, and the redemptive Jesus figure at the end.
Yeah, well,
very
yes.
cool.
Very glossing over it, because this whole book is kind of a gloss in that way, but yes. It's not.
Yeah, and it really is. Yeah, it really is really fun.
Yeah.
Really quick, yeah.
What did you think about Tom Stein? I mean, because he was very manipulative. He was really good at it, but he did use his powers for good.
Yeah, and I think that's the main thing right there. He clearly had powers, but I liked him very much. Mm-hmm. I feel like his heart was in the right place, and he was never... I don't recall him doing anything that was horrible. You know, he did have to talk to, you know, you mentioned some of those other actors that he ended up having to drop in order to properly handle these aliens.
Yeah.
And then, you know, them being complete jerks and him having to deal with them, how frustrating that could be.
Oh, yeah.
But I thought he handled it really good. But I really liked Tom Stein. I thought he was a very good person.
I did, too. And I wonder how much of that came from his father's influence as a literary agent. And because he would talk about his memories about his father talking to the client who was also a Holocaust survivor, who although was Catholic, he yeah. was sent to the camps for hiding Jews. And then, of course, his grandmother was a Holocaust survivor. So there was a lot of that Jewish... The Holocaust was very present in this.
Sure was, yeah. And that's interesting, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, do you see anything deep in there?
Well, it's just the... Well, it's funny because it's such a deep, serious thing. And when you put it against this Hollywood agent, very light thing, and it doesn't drag the book down. It actually kind of gives it a little bit of needed heft, you know?
Sure.
But to me, it kind of explained a little bit of why maybe he was an essentially good person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because even when he's talking to the director after Michelle is in a coma, and she'd gotten a $12 million advance for this movie that she was having the latex mask made for. And the director comes over going, well, she can't be in the movie. I would like my money back because I need it to make the movie with a different actress. And after unmasking the fact that he doesn't really need that money for that, he shows him a way that he can take that money and do something completely different with it. He still won't get it back. But by donating it, giving it to Michelle anyway, of course we would, then take the money and set up a trust or something like that. I can't remember what it was, but it was something very noble.
Right.
And so it was business, but it wasn't business the way you think of Hollywood really doing business. He always managed to find that little extra edge. He wasn't a do-gooder, but he just knew how to spin it and then use it for the best.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
I guess the villain, the real villain of the book was that Van Doren reporter.
Yeah. Yeah. Frustrating fella.
Tenacious.
Yes. Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, that'd be a good villain. You know, just misinformation is the worst.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Yeah. When they're at that.
Writing stories, you know, that aren't even true and putting them out there. And oh, that's frustrating. And, you know, so many people just believe everything.
Mm-hmm.
Everything. Yeah.
Because, like, when Tom Stein's going, well, no one reads The Biz and no one believes it. And Miranda's like, my mother reads it and believes it. Oh.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Yep. No question. Yeah. But I agree with you. Yeah. If you had to pick a villain, that would be it. Yet he is the one who at the end also was kind of redeemed.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as he's the one that decides or looks into Michelle's mind to find out what her final thoughts were.
Yeah.
Yep.
He's the objective human interpreter who sees in the humans what Joshua cannot see.
Mm-hmm.
Because Joshua's never been human, so he can only interpret so far by actions, not by intentions and what's in Michelle's heart.
Yeah, and that's, again, part of what was so touching, the intention,
mm-hmm.
Which is everything to a Catholic, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's the root of it all.
Yeah, I know. I was just thinking about that. I was thinking most of this book is based on that sort of thing.
Yeah.
Which you don't expect. It really is a light, funny book.
I sure didn't, yeah. Well done, Mr. Scalzi.
Yes, because I was really surprised when I was reading through this, and as happens, as you've mentioned, and me too, you know you're going to talk about it, so you suddenly start thinking about it a different way, and that's when I started writing all these notes down, and I was really surprised at what was there for me.
Yeah, and me too.
Yeah.
And now there's even more.
Yeah, that's right, because we both talked.
That's
and
heck yeah.
Well, and it does make me wonder, because the real thread underneath all this, aside from it's connected with the we judge by appearance and quick sound bites and stereotypes and all that, is what is it that really connects us? Because that's what the aliens are looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they feel like they understand that we're all connected. But what is it that connects us all? And I don't know that that's a question that we can really answer, but
sure.
I think that's kind of what this leaves us with.
I agree. That's a good thought. Yeah. All part of the same thing, even though they were aliens.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, because it goes along with the acceptance speech at the Oscars, which was a wonderful...
Right.
Scene. Mm-hmm. There were so many wonderful scenes in this thing.
Yeah.
Where she's talking about the award that she's just won. Talk about a spoiler. But she says, you know, she's saying, well, the award belongs to this person and that person, and says it belongs to those who initially protested my getting this role because they came and gave me a chance to perform it and realized that while I did not match Rachel's appearance, I would try to match her heart. Over and over again, I have seen people of all stripes look beyond the appearance, look beyond the otherness, and see what it was that truly connected us all.
Hmm.
And then comes the huge reveal. But I am an alien. But that's, I think, the heart of the book. Although I don't know that that's what he started it for, but that's what it wound up with.
Yep, and that's neat. You know, who knows if that's how what he started it for, but it's cool how that kind of comes out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And yet it's still one of those books that you can read, reread, and it's so enjoyable.
Would you have given back the Oscar?
No.
Remember at the very end, after right. the speech and everything, he says, yeah, they let her keep it.
That's right. They should, yeah, because somebody had sued saying, yeah. she's not even technically human, and we're pretty
and
sure
leave
we can't
it to
tell
somebody,
her she's female.
Leave it to somebody to sue her, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the other thing was, that was the only thing that really kind of bugged me about the book, because they kept saying, well, we never did find out who won Best Director and Best Actor. And I'm like, are you kidding me? That would have been in the newspaper that day. I mean, or the next day. Just because right. the results weren't named, that doesn't mean they would never have told who won.
Yeah.
So that did annoy me. But other than that, it made a good story.
It sure did. And thanks for picking it.
Oh, I'm glad you liked it.
Yeah, I did.
I'm glad there was more in there than I thought when I picked it.
Well, you must have picked it for a reason. I thought it was great.
Yeah, well, I just...
Very, very fun.
I wanted
great.
Something that was a fun read and also... I have to say it, short.
That was only one tenth of a source.
I know. I was really
or one twentieth. No, one fifth of a source.
Yeah,
that's right.
I was really not Miller. Holding up my end of the deal, but it was summer. I felt we needed something simple.
Yeah, and well done, well done. Well, cool. All right, so our next thing is Man for All Seasons.
That's right.
Movie. And then after that, we're going to do a book that's also not very long, but is wonderful. It's called Pavan by Keith Roberts.
I've been looking forward to that. You've
I hope you enjoy it.
Yeah, you've mentioned it on Reading Envy.
Yeah.
So I've been interested since then. Now, did you listen to the audio when you did it?
I've heard it's no, confusing. I actually read it, yeah.
Okay.
I would recommend reading it. Yeah. You say it's confusing. It may be confusing on how the parts are all stitched together, but I think that it would work on audio.
Yeah, I saw it on Audible, and somebody was saying that they had read it already, and so for them it was fine, and somebody else was saying they had to stop and get the actual book because it was too confusing to keep track of everything.
And interestingly enough, the audiobook is a Neil Gaiman Presents audiobook.
I saw that.
Where Gaiman picks books that he would like to have made into audio and gets them made and publishes them on Audible.
Does that not seem like the most fun ever? Does he not seem he gets to have a great time?
I think he does.
And I don't even begrudge it. He seems so happy and wonderful that I'm happy for him to do that. You know?
Yeah,
he
well
seems
done.
Like a great guy.
He does. Well, cool. Hey, can I talk to you about FantasyCon and why Simon Pegg is my new best friend?
Oh, I didn't hear any of that because the audio just came back. I'm sorry.
Oh, are we back?
Hello? Yeah, okay.
Okay, I wanted to talk to you about FantasyCon for a minute.
Oh.
And why Simon Pegg is my new best friend.
Oh, do tell. Will you introduce me? Because I'd love to have him for my new best friend, too.
Heck yeah. So I went to, with my daughter, in Salt Lake City over the 4th of July.
Mm-hmm.
It was the 3rd, the 4th, and the 5th. We went to WesterCon, which is a literary convention, science fiction.
Mm.
And across the street was FantasyCon, which was a media convention, like a Comic-Con type of a thing.
Perfect.
So yeah, I was like, wow.
Yeah, and, the whole package.
It was for my daughter's birthday.
Okay.
She said, yeah, let's go down there. And she got her picture taken with Billy Boyd.
Uh-huh.
And, yeah, he was pretty great. That was pretty neat. So at WesterCon, there was Cory Doctorow and Mary Robinette Cole, the whole Writing Excuses people, Cole and Sanderson and Dan Wells and Howard Taylor. That was really the highlight of that. Got to see some of the Writing Excuses podcasts being recorded.
That sounds great.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun. And then FantasyCon, the big one for me was Simon Pegg. And I just saw him, you know, they go up there and just take questions. And someone asked him, you know, are the people in the Cornetto trilogy or responsible for it going to make more movies? And he said, absolutely we are.
Yay!
And he says, as a matter of fact, tomorrow I will be meeting with Edgar Wright and we're going to be talking about what we're going to do next.
I'd say something, but I just swooned. with excitement.
So thumbs up. So me and thousands of other people were there.
Thank you for your influence on him, by the way.
You bet. Well, but I think the highlight of FantasyCon for me, other than being there with my daughter, was Doug Jones. Have you ever heard of Doug Jones?
This is familiar.
Yeah, I did not know who Doug Jones was. I was looking through the program and it says Doug Jones played Pan in Pan's Labyrinth.
Oh, you told me about Doug Jones already in an email. That's why it's familiar.
And he played Abe Sapien in Hellboy.
Man.
So he's like a Del Toro guy. So I got to go to a panel that he was on, and he was really neat. Turns out he's a really, really tall, really skinny guy. And he said that he just started getting these parts because once he got that first one, the makeup artists started to talk to each other. And he says, you know who would be good for that? Doug Jones.
Oh.
You know, because he's got this way of movement, and he's also just so tall and skinny, really long fingers, that he said people love to just stick stuff on him.
We can make him
because
look any
weird. You can make this guy any shape, because he's just the perfect palette.
Yeah.
And he described the first time he met Del Toro. He was somebody called him and said, "Can you be here tonight for a shoot?" And he said, "Well, yes, I can." So he shows up and they put him in this makeup, and it was just for some shots from Mimic, which is one of Del Toro's first movies.
Heard of that,
just a science fiction thing. He said he just had to stand on top of a building and look menacing, just a few shots. And then Del Toro met him across the cafeteria table and just grilled him and took his card.
Really?
And then 2 years later he had a model of Abe Sapien where they were like, and he's like, I know who can play this part. And now after that, Doug Jones seems to be in every single one of Del Toro's movies.
Yeah.
Just because, again, he's just the perfect creature guy. And his stories were just really something.
Is he American?
Yeah.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, the name sounded American.
In fact,
that's
one of the things he talked about, Pan's Labyrinth. And he is American, English speaking. And so he had to do Pan's Labyrinth. He had to be in this Pan thing. He was on these stilts that put his feet in very strange position.
Oh.
He had to do his lines in Spanish, which he did not know. And he's looking through a pinhole. He said he could barely see.
Oh, right.
The whole thing, he said, was crazy.
But he was so good.
Yeah, and they said, he was really good. We've talked about Pan's Labyrinth.
Yes.
Podcast.
An amazing movie.
Yeah, it really is something. And anyway, he said that, he'd do his lines and then one of the crew would come over and start speaking to him in Spanish. And he's like, I don't know Spanish. So that's a real compliment. Yeah,
no se. speak it to English.
But anyway, it was fun.
That's
what
so
a
great.
Very, very fun. Yeah.
Yeah.
Trying to think of who else was there. There was a bunch of dwarves from The Hobbit.
Oh, yeah.
About six of them were there.
Okay.
We saw Sam Gamgee and Pip.
Oh, really?
Did a little presentation together. Yep. Pip is Billy Boyd. That's who my daughter got her picture with.
Right.
Yep. And Sean Astin is Sam.
Yeah.
So they did a presentation, and by presentation, it just means they go on the main stage and usually, they'll talk for a while and then take questions. And people love to just ask questions. So that's what they do most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then Summer Glau was there.
Oh, River.
Firefly. Yeah. So that was fun.
Yeah.
Hearing her talk about her career. And it was like, well, I went to Hollywood for a summer and then, started getting roles. And I'm just like, no way. It's funny how some things happen so quickly for people and other people struggle.
I know. It is funny how you just and that's Agents of the Stars talked about that, right? That was Michelle Beck.
Yep,
exactly. Right place at the right time.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why she couldn't act or anything.
Yeah, so Summer Glau got a role, just a little tiny dancing role on Angel.
I remember. Joss I remember Whedon. The episode.
Yeah, and Joss Whedon met her there, and next thing you know, she's River Tam.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Yeah, he likes that type, too, that physical type.
Yeah.
Did you ever watch Dollhouse? I can't remember.
Yes, I did. Some of it, not all of it.
Yeah, same here. But that main character was that similar type.
Right, right.
Very,
Eliza Dushku. Yep, she played Faith in Buffy.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
That's right. And I'm still stuck halfway through season 3 of Buffy just because I ran out of time to ever watch TV extra, you know, so.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I don't know if you ever continue, but there's a couple of episodes that you must see. If you even don't continue, you just.
There's
just
a musical one that I'm dying to get to. But
there's a musical one, and then there's a silent one.
Ooh.
The silent one is called Hush. And by bizarre coincidence, Doug Jones was in that.
Really?
Yeah. It's one of my favorite episodes, and I was like, no way.
Interesting.
You know, I started, you know, after I saw his presentation, I called up IMDb, and I'm flipping through to see what he's done. Mm-hmm. It's like 100 things. You know, he died in this movie. He died in that movie. You know, he was one of these guys.
Yeah.
So.
Well, I'll have to find some time. Maybe I can watch it a half episode at a time. I could do that. It's not so deep. I can't do that. I keep thinking I've got to get back into it and finish it up.
Heck yeah.
And I've got about half the entire thing left. Because I think it went 7 seasons.
You bet. So, yep, I just wanted to let you know that, you know, Simon Pegg and I are pretty tight now.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, I just feel glad that you still talk to me. I'm honored now that you're traveling in these exalted circles.
Yeah, exactly. I'm in Miami, friends with Peg.
Living the high life.
Of course I would still do this podcast.
I don't know. It sounds like you've got a lot on your plate, living the glamorous life with the tuxedos, the champagne, summer.
Going to Monte Carlo.
Yeah. Right, the nice little sports car.
That's funny. Yeah, I'm spending time in the financial district of Miami.
Okay.
Which is a fairly new, everything's new down there, and a lot of rich people.
Mm.
And I took a picture of a car, and I have a friend who's very much into cars. I am not. I saw it, but I could tell it was special. It oozed special.
You sound like me.
So
seemed good.
I took a picture, and I sent it to him. And he said, oh, my gosh, that's really rare. It's $500,000. And what did he call it? I texted it to him. I'm looking at my phone here. It is a, maybe there will be at least one car person here. Almost there. It is a Maybach 62S Zeppelin.
Good heavens.
Which is exactly what I thought it was. That's what I thought it was.
Of course.
Yeah.
6200 Zeppelin, did you say?
No, 62S.
Okay, because I'm going to tell my husband, because he probably does know. He loves cars. That we have any nice cars at all, but he loves cars. So
tell him that Simon Pegg and I are going to pick one of those up for him.
Oh, when you come by, when you guys swing by and bring Edgar Wright with you, we'll all have drinks and go for a ride. Take turns going for rides in that car.
That will be fantastic.
Yes.
That'll be fantastic.
I will just bask in the reflected glory that you shine.
Oh, you bet.
Well, now, have you picked a movie to come after Puff?
I have not.
Okay.
I've got to think about it. Yep.
Just curious.
I got to get that picked.
I am really fighting off a temptation to choose a long book, which is what I've been getting on you about, but I just reread Uncle Tom's Cabin for the third time.
Oh, cool.
And have you read it?
I have not read it, but I've listened to several of your podcasts.
Oh, well, that's nice.
Yeah. So I've about half read it.
You'd have to start from the beginning. It's Dickens good, by the way.
Fantastic.
It just feels like sinking into a nice, long Dickens book, but it's so good in a different way.
Well, you let her rip if you feel the need.
We might have to. I don't know. We're going to have to do it sometime. I'm not sure
Sounds
if it'll be
good.
Next. But.
Cool.
So get ready, anybody who's listening, who's kind of going, oh, no, just start now.
You bet. I love it.
Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, thanks for listening, everybody, to that little extra part about all the cons and stuff.
That's the fun stuff, too.
Yeah, it is enjoyable.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening, everyone, and
yep.
We'll be back in a couple of weeks.
We sure will. Take care, everybody.
Talk to you later.
Bye. Bye-bye. Thank you.